Previously on Cerro Talk.
Are we ready to roll?
Ready?
Yeah. 3, 2, 1.
Comments made on the Cerro Talk podcast are those of the individuals and do not represent Cerro Tech Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers.
Welcome to the Cerro Talk podcast.
Welcome to the Cerro Talk podcast, your portal to the accessible digital lifestyle. www.cerrotalk.com, a production of Cerro Tech Corporation, makers of System Access, the System Access mobile network, and SA2Go. Learn about new technology, cool software, useful websites, education, information, entertainment, user comments, and much more. And now, here's your host, Michael Loff.
Welcome to Cerro Talk Podcast 73 for August 1st, 2011. This is Michael Loff.
I'm Ricky Anger.
And I'm Joe Steinkamp.
Well, I guess one of the biggest news stories is Apple's release of the Lion OS X 10.7 operating system. 1 week later than some thought, but anyway, it is out, and I guess there's a few voiceover problems. Some people having issues that others are not. So I don't know how much of that system specific, but anyway, we had a great Tech Chat 110. David Woodbridge and Pete Bosley offered some great info, as well as Robert Carter, on some known issues out of the gate. Of course, Apple's already working on some updates, and there's quite a few new cool features. One that a lot of people are very excited about is the inclusion of many new voices that you can add, acapella and Nuance, and I think some others as well. So if Alex isn't your thing,
I'm not aware of the acapella voices. I think you still have to purchase those, but you do get real speak, compact, and high quality voices. So now you can have Samantha on your Mac as well as your iPhone. Can everybody say yay?
No, not really.
Yeah, because you get a low res or high res, right? Samantha. You get a high res for about 922 meg or something. So you can have Samantha in all of her audible glory or something.
That's
like
right.
That. I don't know. But
so have you upgraded to Lion?
Yeah, I did it the day it came out.
Yeah, I did as well. And overall, I'm happy with it. I noticed some odd battery drain issues, which disappeared as mysteriously as they began. So I don't know. And I think everybody's finding mileage may vary. And there are just some behavioral differences, like the downloads window in Safari no longer opens. You'll see a downloads button on the toolbar. But people were taking a bit to get used to that sort of thing. But if you are curious about the new features of Lion and want to kind of get an audio tutorial about what you can expect, you can check out David Woodbridge's podcast feed, where he has lots of Lion voiceover demos.
Yeah, you mentioned the Safari and web browsing. Actually, Apple did something to make web browsing safer than ever. There's actually, I guess, two different sandboxes that take place that just should really prevent malware and things. But in the process, they broke some accessibility. But they already have a 10.71 and actually 10.72 in the works. So hopefully they'll get many of these voiceover and accessibility issues resolved early on.
Over 1 million people have downloaded Lion just within the first couple of hours of its release. And I guess with the voices, are you implying that Samantha is the new Reed? Is that it?
Perhaps. I mean, I guess a lot of people have either grown to love her or at least gotten used to her. And I still can't, which is odd to me. I mean, I grew up using a Braille and speak where words that ended with A, the A was pronounced as ah. So, I mean, that was not high-quality speech by any means, but I got used to it. Not so with really any of the real speak voices, but I think it is a personal preference. And some people love it, some people emphatically do not.
Well, other Mac news, netsecurity.org reports that Mac passwords actually can be revealed with a tool called Passware Forensic Kit 2011 because the Mac passwords are left in memory. But in fairness, I think Windows does the same thing. So, you know, if you're really concerned about it, turn your device off when you're not in use. I don't know what the odds are of someone walking by with this particular piece of software, but passwords can be found because we as humans tend to use very simplistic passwords so that we can remember them.
Yeah, and some people will write them on a post-it note and put it under their monitors and so on. As blind people, we don't necessarily have that same issue, but we aren't always security conscious and we'll choose something that's easily guessable. But in other security news, iOS updates are coming fast and furious. The second security patch in 10 days was just released. So you've got another iOS upgrade to install if you haven't done that already.
You know, for some reason I haven't. Normally I get them ASAP and I haven't. I think I'm still
in
4.3.3, but they're up to 4.3.5 now.
I'm two behind, like you.
Yeah, I guess the first one to do with PDF files and the second one has to do with some kind of security certificates. But bring that bad boy up to 4.3.5 and you'll have the latest and greatest version. Charlie Miller is going to show us at the upcoming Black Hat conference how to hack the battery. Actually, the firmware on your Mac that runs the battery. This could either make the battery unusable, i.e. a brick, or he claims, with a little manipulation, it could be used to cause the battery to catch on fire or perhaps even to induce an explosion.
Not good. I found it interesting. I mean, how many people would think to try and hack the battery? But there is an article where he describes how he came across this, and I think he tested about 7 or 8 of them, and he didn't make any of them explode. I think it was intentional on his part not to to make them explode, but he does describe how it can be done.
Well, it's also been found that some of the solid-state drives, the SSDs that we have in the new 11 and 13-inch MacBook Airs, apparently not all created equal. The Samsung units and the 11-inch models write at 246 MBS, megabytes per second, and read at 264, while the Toshiba that you have in the 13-inch models, I think, comes in writing at 146 and reading at 208. So bigger is not always better or faster in this case. So I don't know what that means in real-time performance.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the cards in the current 13-inch models are actually performing even below a MacBook Air that they tested in 2009, so not so good.
Well, what do you do if your iPhone is exposed to liquid?
Scream a lot?
Yeah, you stay away from the Calvo pool. That helps.
That's right.
But short of that, here's the first thing I didn't do, but the first thing you want to do is turn the device off ASAP, because if you can get it turned off, you at least have about a 50% chance for survival. But what you want to do, and we talked about this before with the rice, and that's one option, but what you want to do is wrap your phone in a towel and get to your local favorite hardware store ASAP, and you want to buy something called Damp Rid, just like it sounds, D-A-M-P-R-I-D. Sometimes you can find these inserted along with your shoes and other things like that. So maybe we're going to keep those little packets that come with your items to keep them dry. But anyway, you insert this Damp Rid along with your iPhone into a Ziploc bag, or preferably a freezer bag would be better if that's an option. And if you can't get to a hardware store, you can surround your iPhone in rice and store it in a warm, dry place for a period of 24 hours.
Do not get impatient and go, I want to look at this at 17 hours. I miss my phone. Definitely wait the full 24 hours if you expect to get any sort of good out of this treatment.
My parents just recently washed their phone. The phone was actually in the washing machine, and we did this just recently, and it did actually work. But this was not an iPhone. This was one where we could remove the battery. But like Ricky said, don't get impatient. You literally want to move to another phone for a little bit. But it sounds crazy, but it works.
Yeah, so the Damp Rid's 3 to 4 times more effective than rice. So if you can get a hold of some of that for about $5 for a packet or two, or even if you have to pay a little more and get a pail of the stuff. Sounds like a pretty useful tool to have.
Yeah, it does.
Uncooked rice, by the way, not cooked rice.
Yeah. I got some Rice-A-Roni in the cabinet. Think I'm going to take that out, stir some iPhones up in it, and
Yeah, we didn't do this story, but apparently it was someone in New York, some guy made his girl eat parts of the iPhone or something crazy like that.
Oh, yes. I heard about that, and he was arrested for that, so
I would hope. Don't try
this at home, yeah.
I mean, I love my iPhone, but lots of toxins in there. Not good. Don't feed your lady an iPhone.
Plus, glass is kind of not good for the insides either.
No, not at all. Well, it looks like, at least according to the rumor mill, the iPhone 5 will be coming out around the second week of September. But whenever it is, a lot of people are doing something they really shouldn't be doing. And I can speak to this, still owning the iPhone 3GS. But an article talks about avoiding the desire to get the 3GS to save money and get it for only $49. Because first of all, you're still committing to a two-year contract that you're going to pay about $2,000. So the way you need to look at it is, do I want an outdated piece of technology for $2,049, or do I want to spend another $150, $21.99, and have a current phone that has a much better camera? Because quite honestly, the camera in the 3GS is poor, and trying to accomplish OCR is about impossible.
Yeah, and the processor?
Yeah, the processor is really slower than many, many other phones, even of that age, that time frame. No video chat capabilities, so if you want to talk to people on Skype or the gyroscope, which many apps require and almost renders them useless by the absence of the gyroscope being there.
And if you think about it, you know, why get a piece of technology that's already 2 years out of date and it's going to take you another 2 years to be eligible for a subsidized upgrade?
And iOS 5, the latest operating system, is, you know, many features aren't going to work on the 3GS. So resist that urge, folks. I know many people have done it. They're thinking of the short term, but think of the long term and how much money you're going to spend in 2 years for that contract is what you got to think about. But contrary to popular belief, touchscreens are actually, not all cases, but in most cases, actually better for those with motor impairments. And this article talks about four different ways that touch devices are helping those with differing disabilities. One is to use the device as a communicator, and it talks about using something called touch to speak, that in the past they paid about $8,000, and I've seen technologies like that at ATIA.
Yeah, I have too.
And now you've got it down to like $499 for the iPad and $189 for the software, so you cut it down to $700, or saved over 90% on that. Number two is using it as a therapeutic device by putting the iPad on just things like a treadmill to motivate people who may not otherwise want to exercise to improve their physical activity. Number three is an educational tool, and I didn't know that 80 to 90% of autistic children benefit from using iPads either in schools or the home.
Yeah, apparently many autistic children find it very easy to use the touchscreen on the iPad, and it's very intuitive to them, and it works very well as a tool for all sorts of things. The last way in which the iPad is benefiting people is as a behavioral modification tool or a behavioral monitoring tool. Whether you're using this as perhaps a memory aid or something like that, or you as a parent are keeping track of certain behavioral characteristics in your child, it works very well for that. And the one thing that they did point out, which I think is absolutely true, is that the iPad and any technology for that matter is not a cure. It is something that can help your child and can motivate your child, but you can't just say, okay, I bought the iPad, here you go, and sort of walk away from it. You have to have some goals in mind and use the technology to help in achieving those goals rather than assuming that it's going to be the end-all be-all of solutions to all your problems.
It's estimated there are 40,000 special needs apps written. That's amazing.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Well, Dragon version 2.5 for the Mac has been released, and for those of you who don't know, that's for voice recognition. But now you can actually use the keyboard and mouse, whereas in the past they blocked that. And thinking, well, if you're going to use voice recognition, you don't want to use the keyboard or the mouse. And it was the most requested feature, myself included. I remember contacting them, you know, saying, hey, as great as voice recognition is, it doesn't always work. And sometimes you need the ability to intervene to get the device to do what you want.
Well, we talked in the last podcast about Ariadne GPS and what it is and what it isn't, but that was just a very brief discussion. If you want to get an idea of the power of this app, Mark Taylor on the Candleshore blog and podcast has done an episode called Taking It to the Streets on your Apple iOS device with Ariadne GPS, so that's definitely worth checking out.
The Indiana Data Project has compiled their own list of accessibility apps for iPhone, iPad, and iPod Touch. You can get the link over at serotalk.com or follow them on Twitter. Their ID is IN Data Project. Alana Roberts has written an article following up on Ricky's review, and you are given attribution there. They link to that as well. She wrote it for Matilda Ziegler. It's entitled, Bleo Reader Continues to Disappoint Blind Users. And her negatives include ineffective navigation, limited only by character or word, unless the book's TTS enabled. No tutorial built into it, and no free books. And as someone else pointed out, I heard somewhere that they tested, this was in the tech chat mention, where they tested five different books from three different providers, and Blio in all cases was more expensive to purchase
yes,
the
indeed.
Books.
Indeed. The show that was mentioned in is actually Tech Chat 111. This month in assistive technology for July, myself, Aaron Edgar, and Lisa Salinger talked about what happened in the month of July. So you'll definitely want to check that out. It's a pretty good show, if I do say so myself. We had really good guests. They had some fantastic things to say on that show. We talked about how this month seems to be chock full of book news, such as the release of the Read to Go app from Bookshare. We've got Robert Carter sharing his initial impressions of the app, and you can check that out, as well as the All With My iPhone podcast. In podcast 35, Corey explores the Read to Go app.
And Amazon now allows students to rent e-text books. Of course, these are Kindle, so you have to have a Kindle reader to do that, but you can rent the books for 30 days, and they can be extended in one-day increments. The article didn't say what the cost for that was, and I guess that varies,
no.
Just as the prices of outright book purchases would vary. But other publishers are also involved in that.
And apparently you can keep any notes that you make on the book that you've rented. Unfortunately, that process is not accessible on the Kindle, so you can't add notes to a book in the Kindle. And I don't know if the same is true on the PC, but it would certainly be nice in the case of textbooks to be able to make your annotations and refer back to those.
Well, Apple in-app purchase policy changes have really closed the door on in-app bookstores. Includes Amazon and had to remove their buy button. I think it carries over to Google and, of course, Blio. We talked about that in Tech Chat 109, a very interesting tech chat. How you basically have to use a separate Safari browser to go get the books because Apple's 30% cut is just too much for these companies to swallow. But speaking of Google, looks like book publishers, they now have until September, on the second week of September, to come up with some new agreement. This case has been going on since 2005 and isn't likely to be resolved by the end of this year. But the current agreement would allow Google to make available all of their scanned books and without necessarily paying royalties to publishers, especially things that are out of print. So there's a lot of opposition to that. And I know NFB and a lot of folks want to see this happen and get all these Google scanned books available for us to read, but there's going to be a lot of turmoil there with publishers on that one.
Exactly. Well, if you're looking for some free books, there is a site which covers 87 different places that you can get free audiobooks. And this is absolutely fantastic. These are not just public domain books, and they're not restricted to any specific genre. So you can actually get very high quality audiobooks free. And by the way, you can do this legally. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, I like the way he broke them down by categories, children's books and science fiction and fantasy and computer and internet and just a whole wealth of different categories, biographies and autobiographies and memoirs, one of my faves. So you can check that link out over at SerilTalk.com. That was, I believe, Ian Gizmo Richards, who's finds a lot of cool stuff on the internet and makes that information available. Looks like the Web Accessibility Initiative is seeking comments by August 3rd on the latest proposal specifications for HTML5. Of course, HTML5 can be used to create applications to do many things, and we hope many of them will be accessible. One thing that's going to be used for, and there are many apps already written, are media players. But unfortunately, none of these, or at least the ones that have been reviewed, offer any keyboard shortcuts or hotkeys to access them. So we're going to have to do some real advocacy to make sure that we have some actual usable media players that are written in HTML5. Of course, nothing else, we will do it ourselves at Serotech.
That's right. If you're a web designer, you might be interested in reading this web page, which covers useful responsive web design techniques. And, you know, I was reading this and thinking, what exactly is responsive web design? But essentially, it's every user is perhaps coming to your site from a different platform, from a different device, and so on. So you're looking at different resolutions, all sorts of things that can change depending on how your user is accessing your site. And the layout of content is really important in that instance, where if you're reading something on a small screen, are you going to have to scroll vertically and scroll horizontally and all this stuff just to be able to see all of the data that you want to see? So this responsive web design covers how you can make changes based on how your user is accessing your site so that it's a good experience for anybody who's looking at what you've done, rather than, you know, this site best viewed with Internet Explorer 6. We don't want that.
Colleen Starkloff writes about the fact that 21 years after the signing of the ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act, that we're really still fighting for full inclusion. And she talks about some very important things. Number one, yeah, we can have all the regs we want, but we still have to work on people's attitudes about disabilities. And when I see blind folks or folks in wheelchairs out in public on a cold day or crossing a busy street, why are you there? Well, I'm actually going to work. Thank you very much. And she talks about things like adoption, and they had to fight the system before they could adopt three children, employment, in-home services, and much more.
Yeah, and this is just something you can't legislate. And some days I feel like we're making a great deal of progress, and then some days I'll see news stories where a blind couple has a baby removed from the home simply because of blindness and things like that. So it's obviously a struggle that continues, but again, I like to be optimistic and think that we are making some progress. We're still going to encounter those people who may see us walking down the street by ourselves and wonder where our carer is. But it's my hope anyway that that is diminishing over time.
Well, the blind community, or many members of the blind community, packed into a courtroom on July 22nd in San Francisco to hear a judge decide whether he will grant JetBlue Airlines their request to dismiss a case that's been brought against them, basically asking JetBlue A to make their website accessible and to make the kiosks accessible to the blind. Of course, their argument is that federal laws override or supersede any state laws that have been passed, and in particular there are three for the state of California. So the judge listened to both sides and will be rendering a decision within about 90 days on that. An article asks, why are we waiting for Section 508 regulations for federal websites when most of them aren't even accessible? And now the entity that regulates that, Department of Justice, now wants to wait until 2013.
Yeah, the article, which talks about Section 508 regs, mentions as well that the same holds true for universities, unfortunately. Not only do you see government websites that aren't accessible, but university sites aren't accessible either, and accessibility in terms of web design is not always, or not even usually, included in the curriculum for people who are studying to do web design professionally. And again, the DOJ was looking at implementing some web accessibility regulations, and this isn't going to happen until 2013. And of course, what that means is they're not even really looking at designing the regulations until 2013. That doesn't even speak to how long it's going to take to implement this stuff.
Well, they also, an important thing was talking about how there's five different entities involved in interpreting and implementing the ADA. So that leads to confusion and, well, good, I don't want to deal with that. We'll let you render a decision on that. And then if we don't like it, if it inconveniences us, we'll come back and challenge it. So I don't know. We've made strides, and yet in some ways, you know, we're no better off than we were 21 years ago. But I think it ultimately comes down to mainstreaming and integration and proving ourselves. And it's tough because, I mean, I've seen situations where, you know, the burden of proof falls back on the employer and not necessarily the provider of the software, the technologies that they use that may exclude someone from walking in and working. Well, it's time for Google News, and it appears that Android passwords are being stored in plain text, at least passwords in particular for email accounts that are stored on the SQLite database, which in turn are stored in plain text on some Android phones. We'll have to see what happens with that.
Indeed. Well, for those of you who are using Android, you may be excited to check out the podcast explaining what is new and cool in Code Factory's mobile accessibility version 1.4.
Well, are you interested in joining the other 20 million people who are currently playing around with Google Plus? Well, before you could do that, you first must get an invite. But how do you do that? Well, hopefully maybe you have a friend who's already using it and they can send you an invite. They have a certain number of people they can bring in. But you could post on Facebook or Twitter and maybe someone will hook you up. I don't know. Or you can actually buy, I didn't know this, you can buy Google Plus invites on eBay for about $1 a piece. If you want to do that, if you're just desperate to get your hands under there. Or they're actually blogs that are giving them out for free. I guess a lot of bloggers are being given so many Google Plus invites and they can hand them out randomly to people they choose who maybe post comments and so forth, which is good marketing. Just remember, if you post your email address publicly there, that sets you up for some spam, but part of the fun.
Perhaps it's worth it. I don't know. Have you actually taken a look at Google Plus yet? I have not had the opportunity to do so. I've been watching the buzz around Google Plus, not to be confused with Google Buzz, but in any case, haven't taken a look at it myself yet. How about you?
No, I haven't played with it yet, but Mike Calvo is very passionate about it, so we'll certainly be taking a look at it, and I was kind of waiting for some updates and seeing what they... It's a very interesting blog post I read explaining kind of the four components of Google Plus. I have to go back and find it and post that here with the show notes because it really breaks down and explains what the technology is designed to do. The big thing I like about it is this fact that you can display messages or information to a specific group of people. It's not like Facebook where it's all or nothing. And I like that concept.
Yeah, I think it's a great concept.
But it looks like many Google Plus accounts were suspended.
Yeah, apparently if you're going to be a part of Google Plus, you've got to use your real name. And some folks didn't want to do that. They signed up anonymously or with names that were clearly not their own. But some people were mistakenly suspended because they had a name which appeared that it might have been a fake name and was in fact not. Now, I don't know how Google is making the determination what sort of data mining they're using or whatever to try and determine who is not using their real names and who is. Apparently, they've gotten it wrong, though, in many instances. And so they did publicly apologize for that, and they unsuspended the accounts, which did turn out to be legitimate.
And what happened to Facebook? They were supposedly... must have a real first name, last name. Now you're seeing all kinds of craziness up there. And I've concluded now that that 750 million people really isn't 750 million people. It's 750 million accounts with many people having 2, 3, 4 accounts under different aliases to do different things. But anyway, I digress. This is kind of bad in a way. Google is shutting down Google Labs, which had many, many innovative experiments.
Yeah, the one experiment that I can think of that I'm very sad to lose, and I hope it does come back in some manner or another, is Google Goggles. There used to be an iPhone app for this, and there was, of course, an Android app as well, where it was specifically using computer-aided image recognition to look at, say, a logo on a package or text written in a certain font and things like that to identify what an object might be. And unlike Omobi and VizWiz and some other crowdsourced applications, this was, again, specifically relying on the computer to make these matches. And I was really sorry to see that go.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of great things came out of there. Google Maps, Reader, Docs. I don't know. But anyway, that a lot of projects are going to be incorporated into other things.
Yeah, they do say that this is not necessarily the end of everything. It's just that you won't be able to go to Google Labs to check this stuff out. You'll have to wait until Google decides how it's going to implement some of these things or if it's going to implement them for the public.
Or if that changes the policy, because Google, at least at one time, had a policy where you could have one day out of the week, you could work on whatever you wanted, and you could work on these projects, and that's how they came up with cool things like news, and well, I'm sure maybe it streamlines the processes. Maybe that'll help with the accessibility efforts. We'll just see what happens with that. But do you ever find yourself wondering what those pesky error codes mean? Oh, I hate those.
All the
404, time. 404, 403, 500, yeah. or even more cryptic things that we see in Windows. But the web page entitled 7 Tools to Find What Those Error Codes Mean, free online resources for designers and developers. You can get the link for that at serotalk.com. I think that'll be useful for you.
Well, if you've ever been curious about what your local hospitals are like, and obviously you don't want to be doing that comparison when you actually need said hospital, you can check out Medicare's Hospital Compare tool to get some idea of what the hospitals around you are like.
That's right. It's from the Department of Health and Human Services. It lets you compare a lot of cool things based on patient satisfaction. You can get detailed information on over 4,700 hospitals throughout the United States. Just enter your city or zip code. A lot of cool things in here you can search on, like hospital mortality rates or how many patients died within 30 days of being admitted to the hospital. I thought it was a very interesting statistic. Or how soon surgery patients receive antibiotics. So some very, very interesting things there. And you can even modify your results based on specific health conditions like heart failure or diabetes. So get the link for that over at serotalk.com.
Well, have you ever found yourself having ordered a package and you're all jumping up and down in your chair going, is it here yet? Is it here yet? Is it here yet? And you keep going out and looking on your front step, and then you get all paranoid that maybe the neighbors took it, which actually happened to me a couple of times. Now, you don't have to necessarily be so obsessive about this because you can easily track your packages with a service called Track This, which will allow you to enter the information about a package, and then you can receive updates as they happen via Twitter or email or even text message, I believe.
Yeah, you can actually go to usetrackthis.com. And of course, they do UPS, FedEx, USPS, which is the United States Postal Service. And you can send it a direct message once they add you on Twitter, and then the bots will send you anytime there's been changes to your information. Now, I don't know how much of course, you don't get auto updates. Of course, you can put any of those tracking codes into the search box on Google as well, and takes you right to the page for the product that you ordered. But this sounds kind of cool. You can get direct messages. It's on the truck.
That's right.
It's been delivered. Are you looking for a way to make tutorials that include what is being displayed on the screen as well as the audio?
Yes, I am.
We found an app called, We found an app called My Screen Recorder that you can try out for 30 days. The cost of it's $49.95, but pretty cool stuff. You can actually capture the screens. And we blind folks, we're happy with audio files, but we can put some visual component to it and actually let people see what we're talking about, especially when doing software demos and stuff. That really enhances
I think that's
functionality.
That's a necessary thing. And I've actually tried similar things in the past, and the challenge has always been, how do you capture the screen of your app without having the windows behind the app still visible or the icons on your desktop or whatever? I'm hoping that this particular piece of software has a way where you can say only capture the window that's in the foreground or something like that.
You have to play with it a little more myself, but that's the trick, because sometimes you don't want the full screen and you want to make sure that you're capturing just the relevant portion of the screen to what you're talking about. Looks like Brian Hartchin has announced his forthcoming internet radio station called Team FM at team-fm.com. He and others have left Mushroom FM to begin this new radio station. And of course, once it is online, we will be adding it to iBlink Radio for your listening pleasure.
That's right. Well, for convention coverage, we were hoping to get some coverage from someone from Site Village in the UK, since we weren't able to jet out there ourselves. And it looks like BBC Radio has the In Touch program, and one of the latest episodes covers gadgets that these guys saw at Site Village. So you can check that out. You can also check out for here in the States, the ACB 2011 Convention Audio Archive page, where they have obviously archives of various things that were recorded there at the ACB convention. Also, you can check out our own coverage for NFB and ACB over at SamNet Radio, and those interviews done by Derek Lane, Joe Steinkamp, and of course Michael Loff. We'll be releasing those a bit later in August to your RSS feed.
And the ACB and Site Village, as well as any NFB audio that we found, is also on a link or category under iBlink Radio called 2011 Convention Coverage. So you can get all the stuff that we're talking about and go over there and give it a listen. We've got direct links to the MP3 files, so you can listen to all those interesting ACB general sessions. Yummy. Jamal Mazrui has released WinBT 2.0. It is a free and open source Braille translator for Windows.
Very useful stuff. And I believe it also does back translation. So if you have something that you have perhaps downloaded from Web Braille and you don't have a Braille note taker or Braille display to read that on, you can actually back translate that into text and read it that way.
And a wiki has been created to show folks how to use various Windows and Microsoft applications with the free NVDA screen reader. Ken Saunders has compiled plugins for Firefox that benefit those with visual impairments. The page is titled Firefox Accessibility Add-ons, and the page contains 30 different plugins.
WebAx. WebAx has compiled a list of free online books covering web accessibility, and who wouldn't be interested in that? So definitely, if you are doing some web design, this is a fantastic resource to check out.
This story hits real close to home because it hits on something we talk about all the time, and that's AT price gouging. And Australian parents are angry, as they should be, because the disability products that their kids need, they're experiencing price gouging. These parents of disabled children are paying, in some cases, twice the amount as if the products were purchased overseas, say here in the United States. So some people are taking matters into their own hands and buying, but they're wondering why their Australian vendors are gouging the government and a lot of people that don't have the means. You know, like I said, some cases up to twice the price just for importing it into Australia.
That's incredibly scary. I mean, a lot of these parents are actually saying, hey, we'll end up paying the $500 for shipping or whatever to get it from overseas, and that's still less expensive than it would be to purchase within our own country. And this is even more disturbing if you consider that even in the U.S., this can be a problem where prices for this type of technology or these types of devices can be much more expensive than many people think is warranted. So, very interesting story there.
Line Bargains has posted an article entitled An Expert's Guide on Making Money from Your Recliner with Online Surveys. And while you certainly won't get rich from this, you certainly can make some money or sometimes get free products and so forth. But if you do pursue this, you may want to use the link that we have at SerialTalk.com. When I worked at the Better Business Bureau, we dismissed many of these offers because many of the sites were just taking payment and then not offering anything legitimate, or they're either outright scams or you only pay just a few pennies for a survey that might take you a half hour to complete.
Yikes. This particular article was compiled by somebody who does this quite frequently and so has managed to weed out some of the things that aren't so legitimate. Now, one warning is that on some of these sites, you are going to encounter CAPTCHAs where there is no accessible alternative. So you're going to need something like Celona or WebVism for Firefox to get past those.
Yeah, and then you have to probably disable ad blockers, but then also have some good security software that's going to prevent some of the questionable shady malware that comes with certain ads. So it might take a little tweaking to get that set up and work right for you. This week, it's finished now, but the Indianapolis, Indiana hosted the Beep Baseball World Series, which includes 16 teams.
I didn't even know this existed.
Yeah, we covered this in Tech Chat 96. You can go listen to that. So I don't know yet who won as we record this, but there are 15 teams from the U.S. plus one from Taiwan. But I thought it was very interesting. I played that back in the 70s, and this is the 36th World Series, and I think they're actually going to get some coverage this time on some of the national sports venues. I don't know if it's ESPN or some sports channel, so that'll be good to give it some recognition that it deserves.
Well, is your video card doing weird stuff where it's displaying red lines across the screen or perhaps giving you a blank screen or any number of other mean and nasty things? You might be able to save the card by putting it in the oven. Yes, bake you up some video card.
That's right, just 8 minutes at 385 degrees, or let's say anywhere from at least 5 to 12 minutes should do the trick. But basically what you're doing is you're fixing bad solder joints. I just wonder what kind of aroma this bad boy
That's what
out.
I was thinking. And of course, you do need to take off any plastic things that are on the card because, you know, having melted plastic all over everything is not going to fix things, as you might think. But you also need to make sure that you put this where the chips on the card are facing upward, because if you don't do that, they're going to fall out when this metal heats up. They're just going to drop right off.
So I've got my keyboard in the dishwasher and my video card in the oven, and I'm not
hard
exactly
in the
sure
freezer.
What I
and your battery.
Freezer, exact. Batteries
yep.
in the
yeah,
freezer.
Right? Hard drive in the freezer, battery in the refrigerator, 40% at 40 degrees. I remember that, so... God, your kitchen's going to be full of your PC before it's all over.
That's right. And again, I wonder about the smell. Mm-mm-mm. Baked electronics.
Yeah. Is it pizza, casserole? I don't know what it is. But this is a very, I don't know what to think. This was kind of, I don't know, blew my mind, actually. Bill Gates, the man who said 640K is enough for anyone. But basically, after he realized to move on from Microsoft, he has his charitable foundation with Melinda. But he's calling for a reinvention of the toilet. And very alarming stats here. 40% of the world's population lack flushing toilets. More than 1 billion people, we're about to have 7 billion on the planet, but 1 billion people defecate in the open.
Wow.
1.2 million children under the age of 5 die each year from diarrhea. And this foundation is working to develop waterless toilets that do not rely on solar connections and that might actually even turn human waste into fertilizer or even safe drinking water.
That's right.
Wow.
Charcoal as well. So they really want to come up with ways to recycle this waste and do something useful with it.
And that leads us to our final story, that 19% of people end up dropping their phones into the toilet.
I have never done this. I've dropped a Victor in the bathtub, but never my phone in the toilet.
I dropped a remote control to my first hi-fi VCR.
I'm not even going to ask why you had
it was
it
in my shirt pocket, and I just bent over. No, I wasn't.
Sure.
No, I was just in my shirt pocket. Yeah.
Maxing and relaxing with the VCR remote.
Yes, the VCR remote in my pocket.
Bubble bath. You know, you had your Hugh Hefner dinner jacket ready to go. You were set. At least that's what I'm envisioning.
But that was my baby, though. That was the first VCR I could program myself. I figured out how to do it. It was a Hitachi back in 1984.
Sweet.
And it was hi-fi. I used to record my radio show and record CDs and albums and say, you remember albums? All this stuff on
yes.
VHS hi-fi.
Back when I was in radio, I had one of the Talking Seiko watches, and I loved this watch. And I got it caught on my pants right as I was playing a very long Led Zeppelin song. And I remember seeing my watch arc up into the air and drop into the toilet.
Dope.
And I had to make a very, very quick decision of how much did I love that watch and how many minutes were left on In Through the Outdoor. So it was a very, very, just to save any kind of dilemma, I did grab the watch and wash my hands. But I really loved the watch. I really did. So it was a necessary thing.
Well, what's interesting about this article, and I kind of wonder like how they did this no doubt extremely accurate statistical survey. But yeah, they found out that 19% of people drop their phones in the toilet and 39% of people actually bring their devices into the loo in the first place.
And 45% of the people were not necessarily truthful during the survey because they didn't want to admit that they've done it.
That's right.
Well, it's a new way to read those magazines, man. Your iBooks.
We should reach out to Hims and Humanware and a couple of our friends and see how many Daisy players have ended there too, I would think. It seems to be a common thing.
I bet there's a lot. Yeah.
Victor in the tub. Wow.
And it survived. Hey, I got to give it to Humanware. Yes, the tub and actually a second submersion in the sink as I was washing dishes and, you know, had headphones plugged in and moved a little bit more than I should have. And but hey, the bag of rice later works. Yes, bag of rice and a replacement battery later, all is well.
But we don't advise that at home.
No, do not test this.
They made extreme efforts to waterproof the NLS players, so I don't know what it would endure, but I'm not recommending that you do that.
I left my cake out in the rain. I left my book out in the rain. There's a song title there somewhere.
Well, stay tuned. We're going to be speaking with Victor Sarin from Yahoo and find out some cool stuff that they're doing. Also caught up with Kevin Chow to talk about the STEP project, the Student eText Pilot Project. It's a two-year grant to make college books accessible and save us money because you can rent them for the semester, whatever term you need, saving you 52 up to 65%. So all that coming up on Serotech Podcast 73.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.
No ticker, no ticker. I got to leave this blind yet.
Oh, several of the staff at the Serotalk Podcast Network tried out for American Idol, and we quickly found out that we're better at talking than singing.
And good talk is what we do best.
You're listening to the Serotalk Podcast Network.
For the Serotalk Podcast Network, this is Michael Off, and I caught up with Victor Sarin of the Yahoo Accessibility Labs to talk about kind of what's new in terms of making a Yahoo services more accessible. Thank you for joining us today, Victor.
Hey, Mike, thanks a lot for inviting me to speak in front of so many people. It's great. I'm always happy to do that, especially when it comes to accessibility.
Give us a little background history on the Yahoo Accessibility Labs. When did it begin and kind of what have you done to date?
So we've been in existence for about 3 years. I joined Yahoo about 5 years, so you can do a little math there and figure out it took me about 2 years to get things off the ground. So it did take a bit of time, but 3 years ago, we opened Accessibility Labs. And essentially, it's a place where we train, educate our engineers and developers on accessibility, as well as do some research in some emergent areas, such as mobile phones and web content and things like that.
Okay, so I know you did a presentation at the NFB convention in Orlando, Florida. And I guess two of the things you talked about were some enhancements to Yahoo Search as well as better use of Yahoo Email. Why don't you talk about those things, Yahoo Mail?
So we recently introduced two new products into the family of a bunch of other things that we do. As you mentioned, one is called Yahoo Search. We call it Search Direct, and I'll explain in a second why. And another one is called Yahoo Mail, which is a new, updated, more dynamic version of our more known Yahoo Mail Classic, as people call it. So Yahoo Search Direct, essentially, it's a website that allows you to hear search results in real time. So that means as you type in the edit field, you don't have to hit the search button in order to be able to hear the related content. So for example, if I wanted to find out latest Giants game in San Francisco, I would start just typing Giants games in San Francisco. And as I type, I'd be hearing suggestions that pop up on the screen. And then I have a shortcut key that lets me jump directly into the content to decide whether it's something I'm interested on in or not. So it's very dynamic. We took a stab and to sort of see if we can make screen readers work reliably with this kind of content. We had to go through several cycles to get this thing working. So if you want to try it out for yourself, it's search.yahoo.com. By all means, send us feedback, and we're going to talk about feedback channels before the end of this podcast. So this is the first product. The second one is Yahoo Mail, where we decided to try out a new way of looking at mail. Classically, people browse the websites in a way that they learned a bunch of shortcut keys that allow them to jump between headings and lists and links. And we thought, why don't we try to build something that works inside the browser and feels as if you're using Outlook or one of the offline mail readers that people are used to. And so this is what we've built with our new Yahoo Mail, which means that if you're in a message list, you would be using something like up and down arrow keys to go between messages. If you want to open the message, you press Enter key. If you want to move between messages, you would be using Control comma and Control period. As you press the shortcut keys, the screen reader will announce to you the new message. You know, if you want to reply to someone, you just hit R. And as you do that, you know, we'd be guiding you. We've relied on some of the latest features of Firefox and Internet Explorer, as well as NVDA and JAWS screen readers. The users will need the latest of these technologies to be able to take advantage and enjoy the new Yahoo Mail. We still have Yahoo Classic Mail, so if people don't want to or they're not ready to jump into the latest and greatest, they can still continue using Classic Mail. They can switch back and forth between the two as they like. But the reason we build this thing is because we're hoping this is the future of the web, and we want blind customers and blind users to enjoy what everybody else enjoys, even if it means learning some new tricks along the way.
Okay, so let me clarify. You said you have to have either JAWS 12 or the free NVDA screen reader.
Exactly.
And then what are the differences between using the four browsers? You have to use Firefox to get all the features?
Ideally, Firefox is your best bet. It will work with IE8 and IE9, although the experience isn't going to be as smooth as with Firefox.
And what about Safari or Google Chrome?
Google Chrome, I probably would suggest hold off on using Google Chrome with Yahoo Mail or any of the dynamic websites, simply because screen readers don't support Google Chrome as well as other browsers. Safari, we're getting there yet. We're working with Apple on figuring out some of the small things. So if you have to use Safari, then I would suggest to stay with Classic for now.
What about ultimate support for other screen readers? Do the screen reader manufacturers need to come to you, or are you reaching out to, say, folks like Cerotec or GW Micro with Window Eyes, or how does that process work?
Because of the bandwidth, we obviously can't reach out to each and every one, so we absolutely encourage Cerotec and everybody else reach out to us. We've designed our interface to be as web standards as possible, so we try not to create any sort of workarounds. And so by doing that, we're hoping that it's going to make it easier for screen readers to make their stuff work with our products, because we're not trying to create something for JAWS or NVDA or System Access. We are creating something that is universally accessible, and then we will work with screen readers to make sure that whatever else we need to do on our side to make their particular applications happen, and we'll do that. So please do come to us, and we're easy to find, as you probably might know by now. So,
okay, yeah, we'll give those resources right to find you on Twitter, right, and YouTube, and so forth shortly. Cool. So what gives Firefox the advantage? Is it the support for ARIA, or why does Firefox stand out?
First of all, there are two things worth mentioning. One is Firefox supports the latest technology such as ARIA. And ARIA, it stands for Advanced Rich Internet Applications. It's an essential feature within the browser to enable someone like us or anybody else who works on dynamic applications to be able to provide that great experience for screen reader users. Without ARIA, we really can't do that. We, of course, could build very old websites, but then again, for inclusion reasons, I do think that in the assistive technology field, we need to push blast over technologies, because 2 or 3 years from now, we may no longer have a choice like Classic Mail, or we may no longer have a choice of using the websites the way we used to using them for the last 10 years. So it is critical that people hold on to us, and you know, we will be as responsive as we can to make sure the transition is as smooth for users as possible. But to answer your question, so there was support for ARIA, and the second important reason why Firefox is so great is because their accessibility team has been very, very responsive. The minute we found bugs, as we were developing Yahoo Mail, for example, we found a couple of bugs within Firefox, and the guy said, please let us know, and we'd be happy to fix them. And so Firefox has been the most responsive of all the browsers so far, and this is why we have support we have.
That kind of answers my next question, because Mozilla has such an aggressive schedule updating every 3 months. Mm-hmm. So you do have a one-on-one working relationship with them there.
Absolutely.
So you're using the betas as well to make sure that everything's continuing
Absolutely.
To work.
In fact, to the point that some of the features that we've put into Yahoo Mail are going to be available with the latest betas of Firefox. So that is not to say it's not usable, let's say, with Firefox 4 or 5. I'm just saying that as they keep rolling out betas, we keep fixing bugs. So we're totally aware of their schedule, and they're ever aware of ours. So a couple of things I wanted to mention, Mike, which is the Yahoo Messenger for Windows. We have released a version 11 recently, and within version 11, we've taken a new approach, which before we used to have JAWS scripts for Yahoo Messenger, and Yahoo Messenger worked really well only with JAWS. All other screen readers were not supported well, because the Messenger itself needed scripts in order to be accessible. So we've taken, with Messenger 11, which is the latest version, we've completely eliminated scripts. They still are out there on the net, so people can find them if they want some extra features, but we can no longer support them actively. Yahoo Messenger will now work with pretty much every screen reader on the market. It's going to work with NVDA, it's going to work with System Access, it's going to work with WindowEyes, and we're going to continue that path because we believe that our product should not be tied to any screen reader. Messenger 11, we now have accessible Facebook chat, we have video calling, we have voice calling, and we're going to be bringing some new Facebook and Twitter features into the next version of the Yahoo Messenger 11.5, but I can't talk about those right now, but it's just a heads up for those users who are clinging onto Yahoo Messenger.
And folks who do wish to message that way will have to actually use Yahoo Messenger, right? You don't work with third-party apps outside.
Well, so what we do is basically we have a partnership with Facebook that allows us, once you have your Facebook friends, for example, right, you can chat with them basically using Yahoo Messenger. They will think that you will be using Facebook, but you will be using Yahoo Messenger. So to the user, it will be pretty transparent.
Right, but I mean, you're not working with something like Jabber so that folks will actually need to install Yahoo Messenger to use.
That's the goal, but like I said, we will announce something pretty soon, so stay tuned.
So how can folks get more information? Via Twitter, I think you have a YouTube page, or maybe just a general page at Yahoo itself for folks to learn more about your accessibility labs and your efforts.
Yeah, so let me mention three social streams we have. One is through our blog, accessibilityyahoo.com. We have a Facebook page, which is pretty active. We've got close to 3,600 users, something like that. So we have a pretty active community around our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/yahoo accessibility, one word. If folks like using Twitter, like I do, I'm a big fan of Twitter. It's twitter.com/yahoo access. This is our handle is Yahoo Access. For those who are on Yahoo Groups, please feel free to join us, yahoo.groups/group/y-accessibility. If you forget any of these things, just tweet us and we'll be happy to repeat that via Twitter.
Now you have a YouTube page as well, right?
We do have YouTube channel, youtube.com/yahoo accessibility. On that channel, we have tutorials on how to use Yahoo Mail, how to use Search Direct feature that I just mentioned, and there will be more and more tutorials rolling out as we release new products for Android and for iOS.
So can you tease us with anything else other than the Yahoo Messenger 11.5 as to some future things we might look forward to in the next few months?
There will be more stuff on the mobile platforms. iOS is our primary focus. Let's just say right now, if you're into finance, we've just released a new application for the iPad. It's called Market Dash. It's pretty accessible, but there will be several new applications that I can't mention right now, but stay tuned and, you know, please follow us. And as soon as things become available, we'll be happy to talk about them publicly.
Okay. So the new mobile apps that you're coming up with, so they will have accessibility kind of in there in the ground level. Can we count pretty much full access to these when they're available?
Exactly.
Well, Victor Sarin, we thank you very much, and we look forward to exciting developments coming out of Yahoo Accessibility Labs.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
For the Serotalk Podcast Network, this is Michael Loff. Now we're speaking with Kevin Chow, who's involved in a project called STEP, with two P's. That's STEPP, combining three different companies, making their books available on a rental basis for college students with at least 52% savings as opposed to buying the book outright. Kevin, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Okay, what is the acronym? What does STEP stand for?
So STEP stands for the Student E-Rent Pilot Project, and pretty much Michael did kind of allude to that it is a rental pilot project, or at least a rental program, and it's a pilot project. It's just started up recently. It's running a grant process that runs for 2 years, and the biggest thing is to see if this kind of model of renting books and making it accessible and that whole sort of idea, how feasible it actually is. The biggest thing to make this succeed would be to have as much people using it to provide feedback and to encourage a model such as this to continue.
Okay, so first of all, let's explain the three different companies that are involved that make up STEP.
So the three different partners are, the main one is the Alternative Media Access Center, who are the folks based out in Atlanta, Georgia. And they are the ones who actually wrote up the grant and are the main ones in kind of steering this and making sure that it's going correctly. There's also the Access Text Network, who's a subunit of AMAC. And there's also CoreSmart, who most people are going to be concerned with as far as creating their accounts, renting their books, and so forth. And that's where people would read their actual textbooks.
Okay, so CoreSmart is kind of the component where you're getting mainly the college books, about 20,000 titles, I believe it is right now?
Yeah, so you're getting the 20,000 e-textbooks through CoreSmart, and that consists of 90% of the core college books that are actually used in higher education.
Okay, so you say at least 52% savings, and you have the capability of HTML5 support, meaning that folks can download at least 3 sections of the book at any one time?
Yeah, that's correct. So CoreSmart has deployed HTML5. It's a public beta at the moment, but they're pretty much soliciting feedback, and it works pretty well considering the public beta, and there's full accessibility there. The idea is you can check out any 3 sections at one time. Saying sections because it could vary. Some books are divided by units, and some books are divided by chapters, and some books are divided by other sort of sections. But you can check out 3 sections and check in 2 and check out another one and so forth. It's up to you.
So this is for college and higher education, right? This would not be for school districts to go pull high school materials. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so explain the process. Where we have to go to actually CoreSmart.com to create our account, or how do we use the STEP materials?
Pretty much the best thing would be go to the STEP website itself, which is step.gatech.edu, where you can have all the information. There's an accessibility page. There's a frequently asked question. There's information about the grant. There's an option to contact us. You can also search for the books, and once you have everything there and you find a book that you need, you can select that book, and that'll take you over to the CoreSmart page. You can then even check out a free sample, and with that free sample, you get full access to chapter 1 of whatever book you desire, and it'll walk you through the steps of actually creating an account on CoreSmart itself.
Okay, so how do you read the books? Do you have your own reader? Or how does that work?
So everything's done within the web browser itself. So it works in, I've tested it in Windows with NVDA and JAWS, and Mac with VoiceOver, as well as iOS, iPad, and iPhone with VoiceOver. And for Mac and iOS, it's all done within the Safari web browser. And all your standard screen reader HTML navigations will work just fine. Headings, go by headings, move by unit, different chunks, or read all, and all the things that people are used to.
Now, how much content of the book is displayed at any one time? Is it by these sections or by chapters, and then you click a link for the next chapter or section? How does that work? Does it vary between books?
It's page by page.
Okay.
So once you're done with one page, you're at the bottom, you hit tab or you swipe or whatever, and you select the next link, that brings up the next page.
Okay. Now, I assume they protect the book, so how do you make notes?
So you have a whole bunch of different options. You have you can do notes right there within the CoreSmart reader, and that will apply to that specific page. You can also copy out specific phrases, words, paragraphs, and so forth for your own notes in a separate document or assignment or research paper and so forth. You have full access to the table of contents, so you can go either by the different sections or chapters or subsections and so forth. You can also do searches within the book by keyword. You can jump to specific pages within a book.
So is the layout and formatting pretty consistent across all books, or what varies between different publishers?
For the most part, it's going to be as consistent as it possibly could, and that's where the main partner, the Alternative Media Access Center, actually comes in. They do what's called tagging a book, where generally with textbooks that come from publishers, they're in what's known as source files. And that's generally not the best kind of format because it doesn't have proper reading order, it doesn't have heading tags, it doesn't have alt text for graphics and properly formatted tables and lists. And there may be some issues with words as far as lack of spacing or hyphens and a variety of issues that make it, it's readable, but the experience could be much better, and that's where AMAC actually tags it. And they try to tag, our eventual goal is to get up to 80% of the titles tagged, but this is a pretty manual, and it is a manual process and pretty labor intensive. But the thing that we're striving for now is to pretty much upon request, if a student needs a book and they find that, yeah, I can read the book, but it's not that good of an experience, just let us know and we'll tag the book for you.
So if I get a list of the books I need a couple weeks in advance to let you know, hey, this is what I need this semester, there will be some priority or an attempt to get those books tagged and ready to go if they're already in the library from CourseSmart?
Definitely. So let's say, I mean, generally when in higher education, if you don't have a book or you need a book by a publisher and so forth, you're going to pretty much, and unless you do it a few weeks in advance, you might get your book in time. But with this, even though it's not tagged, it's still readable. And once we're able to tag it, and if your courses are coming up in a few weeks, we'll bump it up on high priority and get it out to you as soon as possible. But in the meantime, you'll still have access to the book. And you won't even have to do anything different, or you won't even notice anything except for that when the tagged version's available, you'll have access to it right then, right there.
Now, do you have, let's say, per capita or percentage of success rate of finding books for your courses? Does that vary between universities? Because I know some professors actually write their own works, and maybe they don't work with CourseSmart, or what is the percentage? Let's say I need 5 books this semester. How many of those, on average, do you think I'm going to come up with through STEP and CourseSmart?
It's going to vary from professor to professor and textbooks and so forth. But in my case, I found at least 75% of the books I've needed, if not more. But CourseSmart has a consortium with 20 of the leading publishers. So as long as they're one of the major publishers, there's a very high chance that the book will be available.
So 20,000 titles, that in one sense sounds like a small group when you think, well, there's maybe 1 million, 2 million books out there. But when you're talking actual college or higher education books, I would assume then that 20,000 is pretty close. You said 75%, so maybe there's 25,000-30,000 actual current working titles between all the universities, or do we know that?
Well, 75% has been my experience, but CourseSmart says that they have 90% of the core textbooks that are being used in higher education.
Yeah, so it's going to depend on your major.
Exactly.
Okay, very good. Any other points you want to make? It sounds like an awesome project. We wanted to let people know about this before college starts here in August for many folks so that they can take advantage and see how many of their books they can get. You said at least 52% off, sometimes I guess quite a bit more. Huh?
Yeah, it can vary anywhere from 52% up to 60-something percent. I mean, it's definitely been a game changer for me. I mean, even though I've been pretty closely involved with it, but even from when I first found out about it, I was very excited that, I mean, another opportunity where we can use a mainstream service, don't have to scan our books ourselves, use audiobooks, or work out things with the disciplined services and the publishers. I mean, all those things are great and stuff like that, and they still kind of have their place, but it's great that we have additional choice and something that's mainstream with very little hassle and fuss.
Yes, mainstream solutions are certainly always or should be the first option when available. So that's why we wanted to help you promote this. So you said it's a 2-year thing, so it's still a pilot project. That's what the P's stand for. So it's important for folks who need this to use it. Even if you as a student maybe don't really want to use it full-time, maybe just grab 1 or 2 books, just show your support for this, because its future success is going to be based on the number of people who actually utilize the service, it sounds like.
Exactly.
Okay, so give the website once again, please.
So it's step.gatech.edu, STEPP.GATECH.EDU.
Thank you for sharing with us the STEP project. All you pursuing higher education, please look at it as an additional great resource to save 52% or more on those necessary books you have to take your courses. For the Serotalk Podcast Network, this is Michael Loft.
You've been listening to Serotalk. Visit us at www.serotalk.com. Send us an email at resources@serotalk.com or leave a voicemail at 866-997-BLAB. That's 2522. We may read your email or play your voicemail in the next podcast. Join us in 2 weeks as we explore all that life and the internet have to offer. Until then, may you have an accessible digital life.